Duval County Public Schools get a good grade, while Clay County Schools say they might soon file a lawsuit. Video of a JSO arrest on July 4th sparks controversy and some criticism of the Downtown Investment Authority, as the Jaguars say they're closer to a Lot J deal. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. You can join us as we talk about the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. They are here and ready to go and waiting on your call at 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, we'll preview this weekend's big Freedom Fest at the Beaches. Don't miss the live in-studio performance by the headliners, the band Be Easy. And we've got a VIP ticket giveaway, too. So keep listening for that. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a very busy week in the news, we welcome Shelton Hull of Folio Weekly. Good morning.
Good morning.
Stephanie Brown of WOKV is here.
Happy to be here.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jacksonville Daily Record.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union.
Good morning.
What a great foursome they are. And there is a lot to talk about this week. Everything from a potential new deal for Lot J around the football stadium and other downtown development news. Also, new allegations of police brutality in the city after a video goes viral. We'll look at that later. But our top story this morning, school grades are out across the state, and the Department of Education says Duval County Public Schools gets an overall B grade from the state. That is good news for a district battling City Hall to try to get a half-cent sales tax referendum on the ballot to shore up and repair crumbling school buildings across this county. Now, at the same time, down in Clay County, the school board there says it might sue after its city commission blocked a move to put a similar sales tax referendum for schools on the ballot for Clay voters. So, yes, it's summer break, but we're talking about the school system once again this week on the show, and we want your calls at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Nate Monroe, let's begin with you. You've been writing some incendiary columns about this as of late. Let's begin with you, because in effect, you said that city leaders in Jacksonville are salamanders. They need to grow a spine and fund school repair and construction. Strong words.
Incendiary. Salamanders actually have a flexible backbone, I mean, so I'll, take a correction on that.
All right.
But I actually think the problem with city officials, more than what seems to just be opposition to the school tax, is that they seem to have a problem just coming out and saying that they don't support it. And, you know, it feels like we're playing this game where the mayor and some of these council members are sort of feigning that they just need more information before they can move forward on allowing this to go on the ballot for voters to decide it. But it actually just feels like their problem is they don't support the plan and the substantial amount of information that's already actually out in the public sphere. You know, if the mayor just said he was against the plan that's on the table now, that he wants to see more charter money, for example, we could at least debate that. We could at least have a standard that we could hold someone accountable to, but we don't. I mean, it's just this, it's this like absurd game.
Stephanie Brown, Duval County Public Schools is excited to see that they've seen improvement in academics across the district, more schools receiving an A grade. The district gets a B grade overall. As this fight over the sales tax referendum in Duval plays out, what about the latest news out of Clay County, where the Clay County School Board is trying to do a similar thing, put a referendum on the ballot to get a half-cent sales tax to fix up those schools? They're now saying they might sue, as their county commission has blocked them from doing this.
There are a lot of similarities in the two measures. You, for example, have some new leadership that's finally taken hold, got an assessment of the situation. They see substantial needs in Clay County between new construction and maintenance needs. It's more than $600 million. But there are also some interesting differences in their proposal. For example, Clay County voters not too long ago passed a property tax hike to support school safety needs. So now they're looking at a potential sales tax increase. increase. And the wording in the referendum actually had some language about school security. So that was one of the questions that when it came in front of the county commission, they said they wanted to learn more about. Would this be taxing voters for the same issue twice? Could we have more restrictive language to ensure that this was just going to be about infrastructure? So that's just one example of the questions that the commission raised when they ultimately said the school board needs to do more work on this. So they sent it back. And that's what has the school board now considering, well, do we sue to force it onto the ballot? Because the county staff had basically told commissioners it's mandatory that you put it on a ballot. But then they decided to pass it back.
Yeah. Pretty extraordinary. Shelton Hall, Mike Mendenhall in Clay County, they may sue. In Duval County, due to some twists in the law and the city charter, the school board, even if they wanted to sue over this, really couldn't. Isn't that right?
Yeah. So according to the city charter, the general counsel for the city represents both the city council and the school board. So they're actually unable to mount a lawsuit given the general counsel's position on this. And it'll be interesting to see, though, if a potential lawsuit moves forward in Clay County, if that'll put pressure on the incoming city council to actually to take a stronger look at this. And a lot of it's process too. I mean, the city council has to decide, like, is the mandate from the state statute to have oversight of the school board, or is it just process to kind of, you know, execute the will of their constituents?
And Shelton Hall, when you talk about the will of the constituents, polling shows that the public is strongly behind these educators' imperative, where they say they're trying to raise money to improve the condition of school buildings for students. The public is behind this.
Absolutely. The public is behind it, including most of the parents and most of the students and most of the teachers. This news about the school grades comes in at just the right time because it shows that despite all the controversy and all the hemming and hawing, the schools are continuing their upward progress. The students are continuing their upward progress. And I think what has to happen now is just a continued lobbying effort on behalf of the teachers and the students and the parents to get out there and reach out to their individual city council members and to the school board as well to kind of push people forward on this.
Yeah, the superintendent, Diana Green, the school board, the principals, they can all say, look, we've got more A schools this year across the district, a B grade overall. Dozens of schools went up at least one letter grade. Some of them went up by two letter grades. At the same time, there are nearly two dozen schools down at the D grade. A couple received Fs. But overall, Nate Monroe, it's a brighter picture for public education achievements in Duval County. And so how much leverage does that give, I guess, the school board in this fight?
I think that's an interesting question. I mean, certainly we tend to talk about the Duval County public schools in these like apocalyptic terms. But the reality is that there are plenty of schools in Duval that range from adequate to high performing. And as is the case with so much else in this town, there are pockets of need and they're not, you know, sort of evenly distributed throughout the city. They're in specific parts of the city. And, you know, you could overlay a map of, you know, high crime and high poverty. And you would see bad schools in some of those areas, too. I mean, this is really not something that's like different than, you know, the kind of challenge that we see across the city, just sort of generally.
And this master facilities plan the school board has put forth, Stephanie and Mike, specifically goes out of its way to address those historic inequities in poorer and more neglected parts of town, doesn't it?
Yeah, they did an assessment of the entire district to determine what schools need the most, what schools need to be rebuilt outright. And even from the first draft that was put forward to the draft that ultimately is in place now, there were changes made because of some of the historical elements or community elements that weren't accounted for in that initial draft. So there's been a lot of work done. And the good thing is we're not going to have to wait too much longer to really see how all this plays, because ultimately this is back in front of the city council committees just next week. So it's going to be the first committee week for the incoming city council. And this is one of the things that's right on the agenda.
Mike, yes, they will be taking this up before we know it.
Yeah, they will. And it's interesting, the amount of work that's gone into this master facilities plan still doesn't seem to be satisfying the mayor's office. Like Jack's Daily Record editor Karen Mathis had a sit down with Mayor Curry this week, and he specifically mentioned that he didn't see enough detail on prioritization in their facilities plans. He specifically said he wants to see how the first $50 million of the plan is going to be spent, and I think that's something that you're hearing echoed among some of the city council members. I believe Melissa, you had Jacoby Pittman on your show, and she said something similar. So Mayor Curry's opinion will also be kind of weighing on the city council as they take this up.
All right, let's go to your calls now. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. What are your thoughts about the fight in both Duval and Clay counties as educators push for half-cent sales tax referendums for schools? 549-2937. Rebecca is on the west side. Hi, Rebecca. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, get off speakerphone if you could, Rebecca, and talk right into your phone.
Yes, ma'am.
There you go.
Is that better? Okay, thank you. A Clay County teacher, and from what I understand, our district as well as Duval is kind of scrambling for these funds. Obviously, we have aging schools, but our capital outlay money has been recently stripped from the state. Pretty much like every other district in Florida. So we're just kind of some of many that are currently scrambling to try to ask our districts to fund, our school buildings.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if your panel has any insight on whether there's a possibility of pushing back to the state for these funds, or if that's just kind of out the window, because it seems like, you know, we were getting money last year. It was significantly reduced, and then this year completely stripped, and all of the money has been diverted to charter schools.
Before we take your question up, let me ask you, Rebecca, what are your thoughts about the school board in your county where you teach, Clay County? What do you feel that they should sue over this matter or not, as they're floating that idea?
So I think it's unfair, you know, obviously a half-cent sales tax really isn't that significant, you know, in the grand scheme of things. So I don't think it's wrong to put it towards our district. I think that we probably need both the local dollars as well as the state dollars. But I do think that a lot of it is, you know, I don't know if the public really is aware that the reason why we're so strapped at this point is because we've just kind of had the rug sort of pulled from underneath us. And I think that maybe if they were aware of that, they might be a little more supportive.
Well, let me ask you, how bad are conditions at your school where you teach?
I work at a relatively new school. It's about maybe 11 years old. So it's not so bad. I mean, we certainly have, I think technology is probably our biggest issue, because we have so many students and we don't have enough technology infrastructure to support them. We certainly have, you know, AC issues all of the time in Florida. That's a big issue. Things are constantly going out. I think as far as we do have a lot of portables too, because we have so many students and there's just no money to build an actual building. So they just kind of keep adding portable after portable after
sure.
portable. And of course, those buildings, you know, are 30, 40 years old. I had a friend of mine had serious respiratory issues because her portable had mold in it. So there's certain issues like that. And then we have other buildings that are very, very old and, you know, definitely in need of repair.
Okay. Thanks, Rebecca. Calling from the West Side, she's a teacher in Clay County. And Stephanie Brown, one of her questions had to do with
funding
from the state.
So this was actually something that the Clay County leaders had explicitly talked about as part of their debate, in highlighting that those maintenance dollars, those capital dollars, have gone down to near nothing. Now, the way they framed it is they got the impression that this is the state basically telling municipalities that it is on you. You have taxing authority. You need to find the revenue. So as to the question of if this could ultimately go back to the state, it definitely seems the indications are that cities and municipalities are planning to try to take this burden on themselves. The one thing I do want to add too, because this is absolutely a contributing factor. The other thing that is interesting, we alluded earlier to the new leadership that's in place. I found it fascinating. The assistant superintendent in Clay, who's kind of leading this push, actually says he has no idea why maintenance has been deferred for this long, but it's something he wants to do now. So it really is that twofold, you know, maintenance has been deferred and now the maintenance dollars just aren't there like they used to be.
Right. Bill in Mandarin has been holding. Bill, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, thank you. Just want to kind of step one step further back on this raising of taxes or not. It's a battle of the segments of the part of the tax. All I know is that as a shopper, when I go in to, you know, buy my furniture or whatever, I see that 7.5% come up and I don't realize who's getting what part of that budget. I would like to suggest that along with this, this might be a good opportunity to examine the competitive groups like our city council and city government for their inefficiencies that have caused maybe an extra 1% that could be psychologically shared and used in the case of the schools. You can start by looking at the policeman's fire and pension fund. That was $30 million a year extra for unnecessary expense. But I think we need to look at it from that standpoint too and do some auditing of the city governments to see how inefficient they've been.
Okay, Bill, thanks for the call. Shelton Hall.
Oh, that's a very good idea. You know, when it comes to this situation of saying that we need more information about how the money's going to be allocated, more due diligence to be done, that kind of oversight was not applied to something like, say, the Jacksonville Landing, where we're looking at $20, $22 million. It was just sort of thrown right at the problem. That could have gone right into the schools as well.
We're talking about different pots of money, though, that mm-hmm. don't typically commingle, right? Just to be clear.
It is different pots of money, but, you know, this is one city, one Jacksonville, and one source of power with the mayor. And if the mayor is truly dedicated to it, he could do this. He can swing this money around, and ultimately the council will do what he says. If he says that he wants this done, it can happen. And as the lady was saying earlier about mold in some of the portables, we've been talking about school safety all last year. If you've got students out there in portables and you have issues of inadequate maintenance and whatnot, that raises questions in terms of security as well. So you can also open the door perhaps to a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of parents and on behalf of students, because if these schools are some of it's more cosmetic, but a lot of it comes down to literal physical safety and the health of the students.
Right. And I mean, if a budget is a moral document, as people are so fond of saying, what does it say about this county and other counties that we're talking about where you see this extreme reluctance to do basic maintenance for students in schools? What about that?
It's not a priority. I mean, that's really, it's fairly simple to figure that out. You know, the city council, when Alvin Brown was the mayor, extended the gas tax, and the city council did it unilaterally. There was no, you know, discussion about these sort of hardcore specifics and auditing the, you know, what was going to be done with the money. They had a list of projects and they said, here's what we want to fund with it. The half cent sales tax that Mayor Winnie Curry extended for the pension reform plan that he touts all the time. I mean, that plan was wildly misrepresented to the public. I still think voters have no idea what they voted on when they approved it. And that was devoid of, you know, really basic details. My colleagues and I was a reporter and not a columnist then. We struggled to get, you know, like the mayor says he wants revenue projections for this sales tax from the school board. We struggled to get revenue projections for this half cent pension tax even after the council agreed to put it on the ballot. So, you know, there's a double standard that's at work here. And I think it's because, you know, the school system, the public school system is just not as much of a priority as I think a lot of people would like it to be.
Let me ask you, Mike Mendenhall, since you cover city council regularly, how do you see the public pressure on this as the public weighs in strongly in favor of this affecting the city council members and whatever actions they take, how they gauge this going forward?
Well, I definitely think you're going to see an active response during the council meeting. The last time that this was actually up for a vote, there were more than 60 speakers, and I believe it took more than 3 hours to get through them. So, there's going to have person after person approaching the podium of the city council, you know, expressing their viewpoints to get this on the ballot. And some of the speakers at the last time that they approached the city council didn't necessarily even come out in support of the tax. They were just like, we just want this on the ballot so we can make that decision.
Okay. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable with Shelton Hall, Mike Mendenhall, Stephanie Brown, Nate Monroe, and myself as we talk about the top stories of the week. We're going to move on now, and we want you to give us a call at 549-2937. And because you mentioned the Jacksonville Landing, Shelton, I'm going to jump around here in our rundown a minute. And also note that there has been all kinds of news this week about downtown projects. First off, Mayor Curry says the city is close to an agreement on a deal, including incentives, for the proposed $500 million Lot J development Shad Khan and his company want to put up around TIAA Bank Field. The city and the Downtown Investment Authority also say there's movement on a number of other downtown parcels, everything from plans to move the Duval County Jail to whatever will go in place of the Jacksonville Landing. Now, at the same time, there's been some criticism of the DIA and the city, particularly from our partners at the Jackson Mag. They take issue with what they call the Godzilla strategy of downtown development, where the city blows things up and hopes for something new and better to go in the place of whatever they demolished. Currently, downtown has more dead space than occupied buildings. The question is, can that change? Will the DIA and the city's approach bear fruit? Mike Mendenhall, you've been writing about this in the Jax Daily Record. Let's go through all of these projects, beginning with the Jacksonville Landing. As Shelton said, the city didn't have a problem throwing a lot of money at that to take back ownership of it and demolish it, which is going to be happening soon.
Yeah, so I mean, clearly the messaging on the Jacksonville Landing, the way that the demolition was rolled out, did not go over well with some members of the public. But the one thing that City Hall is trying to make clear is that, you know, they are going to move forward with an RFP to decide what they're going to do with that property within the next year, probably more than likely by the end of the year after the demolition is completed. Now, during the whole process of vetting the demolition publicly, the City Hall ended up releasing plans that were originally drafted by the DIA in 2015, but were never publicly released at the time because that's when the lawsuit with the former owners came about. But they've now come forward and said, look, we're going to take these plans into account. There was a lot of money that was invested in these plans at that time. We're going to take these plans into account when we come up with highest and best use for the property.
Okay. How about the fact, too, that the mayor is saying we're moving the jail out of downtown in the next few years? The DIA says seven downtown hotels are planned. So we're hearing a lot of ambitious talk about how downtown is going to change. At the same time, there are a lot of empty lots.
We've heard the hope and plan to move the jail out of downtown for a substantial period of time. It's one of those fundamental, when are we going to actually dedicate the money and resources to start doing it? You know, when we had plans for the Berkman coming forward, you saw in the renderings, you saw the Duval County Jail right in the middle of the renderings. Nobody wants to see that. Yeah. And I remember at the time we reached out to the then developer who was joking about how it would create safety because that's also the police headquarters. So, you know, when you look at a big project like that, we're talking a couple $100 million, is going to have to go into a new jail. That is not something that's done overnight. We've talked about it for a very long time, and every administration really continues to talk about it. So we'll have to see when action, you know, really comes about on something that large.
Mayor Curry has brought this up again and again. Clearly, it's a big priority for him.
Absent hard evidence that downtown development is really taking off, and specifically that there's interest in that site, moving the jail, I mean, we're talking about $400 million. And I mean, that's the kind of upfront estimate. It would be a colossal waste of money to spend that moving the jail without, again, like evidence that actually would serve any actual purpose.
And let me ask you all, too, as a follow up, the criticism of demolishing sites or taking a site down without knowing what's going to go in its place, is that a valid criticism for these moves?
Oh, it's definitely a valid criticism. It's very consistent with how we've done things in this city for quite a long time. You know, the jail was put in place only not even 30 years ago, and everyone at the time was saying it's such a great idea to have it there, and now it's not there. We spent all this money putting courthouses downtown, so if we move the jail elsewhere, we're going to have to take it. It's going to be more money for transporting people from the jail to the courthouse, and you know, and the jail as it is, it's pretty close to City Hall, and I think that's convenient given some of the stuff going on up there.
Okay, here's an email from Mike. Isn't Lot J one of the main parking lots for current events at the stadium and Daly's Place? What are they planning for parking? Also, Shad Khan needs to take a page from TPC and set up a designated rideshare pickup drop-off route to increase the safety of passengers. Mike Mendenhall. People are following this closely. They want to see that area develop. They want to come to it. Infrastructure will be a concern.
It will. And there is a parking structure that's proposed along with this new development, but we still don't know exactly how many parking spaces it's going to have and if it can support both new tenants at Lot J as well as JAG fans. I've actually received a couple of reader emails this week that are, you know, season ticket holders that are concerned that there's not going to be space, you know, for them when this development comes through. Now, I mean, I'm sure that Shad Khan is aware of that. He probably doesn't want to alienate his season ticket holders, but those plans are still yet to be released.
Well, I actually think too, we do know, at least there have been some public indications in a couple of meetings that the city is going to be responsible for building that parking garage, most likely. And it's going to have several thousand spaces. And, it kind of blows my mind, but parking lots are enormously expensive to build. I mean, this is going to be like a $60 million project.
Something else that I've thought a lot about, and everybody weigh in, after we went through Hurricane Irma here in this building right across the street at WJCT and saw the severe flooding that resulted, is Lot J being planned appropriately to factor in the threat of severe weather and eventual water rise?
Well, when you had Lot J under consideration for the JEA headquarters, that was something they talked about, and they were fairly confident in the building structure they would be able to put together, that it would sustain whatever, you know, it needed to in terms of weather for that location. So the team that was behind that proposal, ultimately we know JEA didn't move forward with it, but it is the same team that's behind the Lot J proposal overall. So I would expect a lot of the same features that we did see in that plan, including hurricane resiliency. It's absolutely something that they are considering as part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is smart, because as we learned the hard way, any buildings along the river are vulnerable. The city's adaptation area working group on flooding is looking at this. And as we talk about all of this downtown movement, building codes, all of this, is Jacksonville behind the curve in terms of how it manages the building of new structures and how it retrofits what's already there to protect itself?
Oh, we absolutely are. I mean, a lot of the things that are being proposed, they sound nice. They sound good on paper. They make for nice press releases. I'm really happy about the plans to maybe redevelop the old Ambassador Hotel, which is a great part of the city's history. But this gets back to the trend, well, not even a trend, a long-term pattern going back a couple of generations now of we do a little bit of development, then we do more development, which often contradicts the plans of the original development. We're talking about spending all this money for a parking garage. With the 20 plus million we sank into buying the landing, if we'd spent a fraction of that building a parking garage 10, 15 years ago, the landing itself would still be, you know, a viable, profitable business. And as far as the hurricane stuff, we don't know. We can only take them at their word. We'll take them at their word. And then if something happens, by the time something happens, all the people involved in doing this, they'll be gone. So there'll be no accountability. And then there'll be more plans to demolish more stuff. It's a continuing cycle.
You know, I do want to push back a little bit on the overall concept that nothing that is being done is working, because we have seen some historic restorations taking place. You know, the Barnett Bank building as part of that trio, that is well underway. Part of that has opened up. Obviously, it was a long running project. It took multiple starts to finally take hold. So likely longer than people would have hoped for. But there are restorations that have taken place and can work. You look at something like the courthouse building and the annex building that was demolished. And the overarching question is, what would have been able to use that building? Is that, you know, what we would have wanted to see on the riverfront?
There was some upset about those buildings being demolished, but were they historically significant? Yeah, I think is a valid question. And Mike, 7 downtown hotels in the works, 7 new downtown hotels. That to me says investors and builders feel very confident about the growth of downtown if they're planning that many new hotels.
Yeah, so they're definitely hoping that things like this new downtown overlay are going to encourage growth in street level retail, restaurants, that will bring additional people to downtown. And another thing too, that there's kind of, since now that there's a change of guard at the DIA, when you have a former council member Lori Boyer put in place as CEO, you know, putting aside some of the controversy that may have got her there, she is a very detail oriented individual who it appears is very hyper focused on making sure some of these downtown developments work. She told me this week that the former courthouse and city hall site, they're moving forward with an RFP. They want to get that out by October. They're currently doing a highest and best use analysis of that property, and she even floated the idea of high rise possibly on that site.
Meanwhile, the Semper Fidelis Society has emailed the show asking, what is the plan for the Veterans Wall with Lot J development? That's a good question.
So as part of the broader shipyards plan, which we've seen kind of hand in hand with the Lot J development, their end goal is to have the Veterans Wall be along the riverfront, as far as I'm aware, and really as part a centerpiece of a larger Veterans Park. What we'll have to see is ultimately if they move forward with Lot J first. We know they're not getting rid of the Veterans Wall. That's not going to happen. So we will have to see if there's some kind of a phased approach that takes place and does ultimately end up with a relocation along the riverfront, or if it's, you know, configured into the overall design and kept in that core area. That's kind of one of the details that we will have to see when we get the overall renderings, but it's been made clear that it's not going to go away.
Good to hear that. Jamie is in Lakeshore. Hi, Jamie. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a quick question. So I'm curious where they're considering moving the jail, because we have to consider also there's a lot of resources for people downtown like Schultzbacher. So when they're leaving the jail, they at least have some resources around them. I just feel like a lot of money is being put on lipstick for the city, and we're not really considering like our issues with our homeless populations and whatnot.
Thank you for that. And yes, it's important to point out the Sulzbacher Center for the Homeless is right behind the jail. So that brings up a question going beyond the cost of moving the jail, how it will affect a lot of other entities too.
Yeah, it would be a hugely complicated project, and again, super expensive, and would take a long time. The jail will not be moved and completed when Lenny Curry is in office. Liberty Street was supposed to be fixed in 2018, and it's going to be 2020 before that's done. These timelines are years and years, not, we're not talking about this being done like in 2 years or something.
Yeah. And to answer her question, we really don't have an answer to her question as to where it would go and how these questions will be addressed. We're just discussing it as we learn along with the public. Shelton.
Yeah. And it gets into the whole not in my backyard concept. We want to pick up one of the reasons we put the jail out here is because people didn't want to have it in their backyards or in their neighborhoods. So it remains to be seen what neighborhood in the city is going to want to have the jail put there, and then having all the services that are attached to there. And we don't...
Where are all those bail bondsmen's going to go?
Exactly.
They're all over the place around there.
We had a very efficient structure. Love them or hate them, you know, the whole police station, jail, courthouse set up, that was one of the few things in the city that actually worked in a fairly efficient manner. And this is, if we move the jail outside of downtown while keeping the police station downtown, that's going to lead potentially to millions more in added expenses for transporting prisoners back and forth. And with all the Lot J stuff, it sounds good, but so far, all we're doing is taking a loss. We've already lost Welcome to Rockville. That was a source of millions of dollars in economic impact every year.
Yeah, that festival's going away. Let me ask, though, from the mayor's point of view, it makes sense to move the jail out of downtown because it's just a damper on downtown development, vibrancy. People don't want to live across or work across from a jail. What about that argument?
I mean, is there a project that hasn't been done because the jail is there? I mean, that's sort of where I guess I would. What I'm not really clear on is the urgency to move the jail. What is going to get done if that happens? I mean, I feel like downtown development would be essentially where it is now if the jail hadn't been there for 20 years.
I think it's an interesting bridge because you have a lot of focus on the sports complex. You have a lot of focus on kind of the civil complex, the, you know, interior and core of downtown, and you have the jail smack dab in between the two. Mm-hmm. So I think that as it stands now, keeping the focus on either side, it's not quite obstructive. But at some point, you're going to look to want to bridge those two entities. And that is going to be kind of a crucial point where we see if you can effectively do that with it right in the middle.
Yeah. And, you know, and going back to Shelton's point, the farther you move the jail out of downtown, the higher your transportation costs are going to be. And that's a huge issue here. But also, too, I mean, I know that they're trying to gain residents in downtown. Their goal is to get 10,000 residents in downtown. And although the jail may not be attractive for those people, you move it, you're just going to be affecting another residential population somewhere else in the city.
There is a grass lot that is in between the core and the entertainment district that has not been developed for years and years and years and years and has had false starts. And that's not because the jail is there. It's because there are the larger conditions have just not been in place and not ever been lined up right to build there. Show me why the moving the jail wouldn't just be another blank space. I mean, you still have Maxwell House in between everything, and that's a kind of a giant dead zone too. And I don't think Maxwell's planning to move anytime soon.
I hope they don't, only because I like the smell of the coffee in the morning. But speaking of law enforcement and suspects in jail, we do need to make note of another headline from the week. The local chapter of the NAACP is calling for an independent investigation after a video went viral. It was shot by our partners, News for Jax. It shows a controversial arrest by JSO on July 4th. Now, police were trying to arrest a suspect on the west side. He had barricaded himself inside a house. He said he had a weapon. As police cuffed this guy, the video appears to show one officer slamming the man's head into the pavement hard multiple times after officers had taken down the suspect. JSO isn't commenting on allegations of police brutality. They're saying they won't comment while the investigation is ongoing, although the local FOP president is urging people to wait for all of the facts. Let's note, too, this wasn't shot by a bystander on his cell phone. This was actually shot by Channel 4, Shelton Hall.
Well, I can't wait to see what these facts are. They must be some savory facts. I would say to the general public, if you want to get a sense of what was going on here, wait till it gets to be about noon, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. Go outside to your sidewalk, take off your shirt and lay down in the concrete. See how much squirming you do. It's hot out there. And, you know, I'm not speaking in favor of the, this prisoner. You commit a crime, you do the time, as they say. But we've had a number of incidents over the last few years of police officers hitting, you know, or abusing suspects on camera. And the weird thing about it is they know that the camera's there and they're still doing it. It kind of reminds me of the situation downstate. We just had a guy, a police officer, he was fired in September, but now he's facing charges on racketeering for planting drugs on a number of people he pulled over on traffic stops. And with the situation that set it off, the first major incident, the planting of drugs, his body camera was on. So there's a real disconnect. I mean, at least, you know, in the old days, if you're going to beat somebody up, at least you walk up to the guy with the camera and kind of put your hand up and say, get out of the way. This doesn't look good for anybody.
Let's be clear. The JSO has rolled out body cameras like many other police agencies around the country to try to bring about more transparency and accountability for officers, as these videos have become a flashpoint in racial divisions and resentment of law enforcement, not just in Jacksonville, but everywhere in America. And so, what about the JSO's position that we now are using body cameras so that there is accountability and we can see what happened in controversial incidents?
I mean, I think I think it's good technology and it's something that, I think a lot of people would have liked to have seen rolled out faster. It's good that JSO is going to have body cameras. you know, and all of its officers outfitted with them. But, you know, this gets back to, I mean, just this issue of trust, right? I mean, this is why JSO needs to be out in the community. If, you know, it's one thing to say, wait for all the facts to go out. But if you've got a portion of the public that, you know, has no faith in JSO and has maybe been given reason to not have faith in JSO, that sounds like pretty hollow stuff.
The NAACP is saying we want an outside investigation. That the FDLE should investigate. For years, citizens have called for an independent review board of JSO actions. That has been consistently poo-pooed by local police. Stephanie Brown, you know, it's just the latest in a long line of incidents where, you know, police are engaged in a really tense moment. I think the SWAT team was called out to this. Adrenaline was running high. We don't know the full story, but the video appears to show a suspect being manhandled after he was already down on the ground. And that's where the controversy lies.
And so that's why we have the Fraternal Order of Police saying, wait for the information to come out. Because, you know, none of us sitting at this table, probably most people who are listening right now, can understand being in that moment and the immediacy of the response by either the suspect or the officer involved and what exactly they're thinking and feeling in that moment. But to your point, you know, there have been calls for, as long as I've been here, for independence in those kind of investigations. We know that neighboring jurisdictions will bring in state law enforcement or even other jurisdictions to conduct investigations like this. So far, there's not been much momentum to actually create any kind of change.
Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Yes. Good morning. I just wanted to say that the city needs to handle this very carefully. With this on video, there could be a huge liability impact. This could cost the city a lot of money if this man winds up suing and it goes to court or winds up in a settlement.
Thanks for that. Shelton.
Yeah, that's true. It's happened before. There was the case a couple of years ago where a lady had her hands handcuffed behind her back and she was at the jail. She got punched in the stomach by a police officer. We've had incidents like this before, and it's not just a JSO problem. It's, you know, we don't want to tar the entire department with the brush from a few bad apples. We've heard for years people talking about police accountability boards here and elsewhere, and I think all of that's a non-starter. At the end of the day, what should happen, and I don't know if it can happen, is that the FBI has to step up, you know, and just do this on a national level. The FBI should have their own division that's like devoted specifically to looking at police brutality cases, because, you know, if you're the NAACP, you're pushing for a police accountability board. Why would you trust JSO to get it done correctly? None of these police officers have faced real consequences around the country. You look at all the incidents of shootings and whatnot, and even if you presume that, you know, 99% of all these police shootings and all these police beating stories are entirely justified, you still have 1% that are
and
not.
And we are almost out of time. Just enough time to do a lightning-fast lightning round of stories that you also caught your eye this week. Stephanie Brown.
Well, the story catching my attention today, my station WOKV is holding a carathon benefiting the Child Cancer Fund. So you should obviously keep your dial tuned right here. But if you are able to make a donation to support families going through cancer treatments here in Northeast Florida, the number to call is 855-636-6877.
Okay. 30 seconds left. Anybody else have a quick plug?
I got one.
30 seconds.
The cons, they invested in All Elite Wrestling. This weekend, Saturday, it's AEW Fight for the Fallen, proceeds for which are going to victims of gun violence here in Jacksonville. That can be, you can still buy tickets and you can stream it live on bleacherreport.com.
Thanks for that, Shelton Hull of Folio, Stephanie Brown of WOKV, Nate Monroe of the Times Union, and Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Great weekend and don't go away. Up next, a live in studio performance from the band Be Easy. They're headlining the Freedom Festival at the Beaches this weekend. Back in a moment.
Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A company's cell phone policy can protect your employees and your bottom line. Our distracted driving presentation for the workforce can help.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
The USF College of Public Health offers students career advancement with certificate or degree from Florida's number one public health grad school, as ranked by U.S. News. Fall classes begin August 26th. More info at publichealth.usf.edu.
On the next Fresh Air, baseball great Keith Hernandez. His memoir is out in paperback. Also, we remember former pitcher Jim Boughton, whose book Ball 4 was an irreverent inside look at the game. He died Wednesday at the age of 80. And we remember actor Rip Torn, best known for playing the gruff producer Artie on The Larry Sanders Show. He died Tuesday at the age of 88. Join us
this afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Are you confused by kombucha, stumped by sauerkraut? I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, master fermenter David Zilber joins us to talk about the magic of microbes, bacteria, and fungi, and how to rescue your home fermentation failure. Plus, how mosquitoes know how to find us. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
America celebrates the women who won the World Cup. Stocks surge after the Fed signals a probable rate cut, and the Labor Secretary defends a plea deal for a billionaire sex offender.
We believe that we proceeded appropriately.
The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, the Beaches Freedom Festival is hitting Jacksonville Beach this weekend. Now, this big bash benefits multiple veterans groups, and it features live music, food trucks, a hot dog eating contest, cornhole tournament, artists, vendors, kids zone, games, and so much more. Going to be so much fun and for a great cause. We are so excited to have a preview now and a live performance as we welcome Charles Wagner with 904 Events and Aaron Thomas and Gregory Lyon from the headliner at this festival, the band Be Easy. Hey guys, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Morning. All right, Charles, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit more about Beaches Freedom Festival.
Yeah, so this is the third year that we've done it. It benefits eight different local veteran nonprofits, and it's a really fun community event for all ages.
This is a way to support the local veteran community, which is a huge part of the First Coast.
Absolutely. You know, we created this event a few years ago. One of my best friends was in the military, served in the Marines. And, you know, when he got back from serving, he told me, you know, there's not any real big military events here in Jacksonville that support the community. And so that's when we immediately decided to create one that celebrates our veterans and bringing people together here in the community.
People's ticket proceeds will support the efforts of all of these nonprofits that help veterans. And at the same time, on Sunday, you're doing a summer beach cleanup.
That's right. That's right. Last year, we picked up over 41,000 cigarette butts. And we're hoping to get to 50,000 this year.
So that's a lot of cigarette butts and other trash, too, that you're picking up, right?
It is, yeah. It's, you know, after any type of event and after the 4th of July, you know, our beaches are littered. And so we want to do our part and clean them up.
Okay, let's talk about the band. Guys, tell us about the band Be Easy. Aaron and Gregory, you are the headliner at the festival this weekend at the Seawalk Pavilion. Lots of excitement. You guys are really building a following around town.
Something
like that.
Something like that. Yeah, we've, I mean, this festival in particular, it's always a great time. You know, it's a great cause. We've got a lot of cool people, you know, backing us up, showing support. But there are also a lot of great bands, that are playing.
That's right. Well. It's a whole music festival, lots of live music. And we are so excited to have a ticket giveaway right now for the Beaches Freedom Festival. We have three pairs of VIP tickets to give away for the festival this weekend. If you want a pair, email the show right now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. The scintillating Heather Schatz, our producer, will pick three winners at random. You will have to come here to the station to pick up your tickets, okay? So send those emails to us right now. And we're so excited. We've got a preview of some of the great music from the festival. You're going to play an original song. What's this song, guys?
This song is called Escape.
Here they are, the band Be Easy.
my way to a 24 at a north on 95. Got everything we need and more. We don't have to rush for time. So many questions, answers not yet to find. But we can search together. Promise I'll never leave your side.
Got to see us on the move. The sun will guide us out. And when the music's through, we're gonna sing and shout. Don't let nobody fool ya. I know the place to go. We'll make it last forever. No one would even know.
Just play. Oh, your hand in mine. Ooh, no need to run anymore. We don't have to hide.
Whoa,
this road is ours to ride. Let's escape through the night. Leave this whole world behind.
Said you're down to ride, so let's leave these faces. Relations are trying to divide. I'll take a sip or two, make magic right outside. Lay blankets beachside, the city lights.
No one or nothing could ever come between us. Ooh, it's always you to lift me up when life knocks me off balance. On this road to it up, doesn't matter where we go. As long as I'm with you, girl, promise I'll never let you go.
Place your hand in mine.
Won't you place your hand?
No need to run anymore.
We don't have to hide.
This road is ours to ride. Let's escape through the night, leave this whole world behind.
Oh, beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That is the band Be Easy. Go and see them with a lot of other great stuff this weekend at the Beaches Freedom Festival. Charles Wagner, things kick off Saturday around noon, right?
Saturday at noon. And we're giving away a free commemorative cup to everyone who attends. And the big thing is this event is free
That's
to
right.
attend.
Although we are getting lots of emails for VIP tickets. Keep those coming. Have a great time, you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having
Thank you for having us.
I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.